Welcome to this week's broadcast for the current federal tax developments for the week of August the 27th, 2018. Current federal tax developments, as always, is brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education and by your state society of CPAs. This week, we're going to take a look at a few things happening. The big thing for the week probably we're going to discuss is going to be the IRS's regulations that came out this week, or proposed regulations, on the issue of the various state and local tax workaround rules and the various credits that people were getting that were 100% credit for donations to various organizations. We're going to discover that the IRS took a tack here that wasn't quite what they hinted at in the notice they issued earlier this year, and it's going to have an impact outside of just the states that adopted programs after the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. We'll also talk about a case this week where taxpayers attempted to avoid double taxation in their C corporation, and unfortunately, it didn't work. We're going to talk about the IRS's modifications they have made to the automatic accounting method change procedures to take into account the special rule for S corporations that switch to C corporation status within 2 years after the enactment date of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And finally, we'll talk briefly about the guidance that the IRS issued this week that impacts not-for-profit organizations, the calculation of separate unrelated business taxable income from each trade or business. Remember, that takes effect for this year. So getting a start on that, let's go ahead and go to our first issue this week, which is going to be a case that deals with constructive dividends. This is the case of Pacific Marketing Group et al. Versus Commissioner. This is Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2018-131. It was issued on August the 20th of 2018. Now, this particular case deals with a situation. We had here a corporation. It was a C corporation, largely because apparently one of the shareholders, it appears, was a non-resident alien, so it was not eligible to be an S corporation. It became very successful. And the problem they were running into was that, you know, what they were taking out as reasonable compensation was unfortunately not going to be enough to bail out the income from the entities. And that meant that inside the corporations, they were building bigger, inside the corporation, they were bigger, building a larger and larger pool of funds that were subject to tax. And if they wanted to take those funds out, they had to pay a second tax. They wanted to solve that problem. So they set up a rather complicated structure that was meant to avoid the double taxation. If you get into the structure, basically what they did, they set up a partnership. The partnership was to do two things. It was to provide factoring services, factoring basically of the receivables of the corporations or the water corporations, actually were multiples. It's a little more complicated, but we'll take it the simple approach of the corporations up top, you know, the ones that were operating corporations. It was to get factoring for them. And then it was also to provide various management services, so to take over managing the entity. This partnership then was owned by S corporations that were set up by the eligible shareholders. So we have a number of S corporations, and it actually appears at this time they had at this point become all eligible, but now we had a huge built-in gain problem if we did it at the top corporation. And secondly, we wanted to do something here to get around the tax problem. So they set up these S corporations. So what would happen is they would go ahead. First thing is there would be this factoring business. So they'd buy the receivables from the up from the corporation, you know, the operating corporations. They would then get a fee for collecting based on the factoring, and then they'd turn around and pay that out to the S corporations. They would also then turn around and, you know, bill the operating corporations for the management functions, which is basically the work of these of the shareholders now, were being billed out to the management corporation. The management corporation would then send money down to the various S corporations and its distributions, and those S corporations would pay salaries to these people. And it was an interesting and kind of, you know, it was a structure. Oh, by the way, on top of that, the S corporation shares were all owned by ESOPs. And the only shareholders, the only people in the ESOPs were the S corporation shareholders. Now, this goes back a ways. You probably could guess right now, you think, how that doesn't work anymore. Yeah, this goes back quite a ways before that was changed. So this case has been drifting through the courts for a while. But they have this structure. So the way the structure would work magically is this. They would have the operating corporations. The partnership effectively between the factoring charges and the amounts that were charged for management fees, which, by the way, were the standard amount they would charge for a fee, plus a bonus each year, and a bonus that just magically kind of wiped out the income for the most part of the top corporations, then that would get that money to the partnerships. And as we said, the partnerships then distribute their way on down. The idea of this structure was, of course, to avoid the double taxation, because what they would do, the officers would take a salary, what they needed from the S corps to live on. They would leave the rest of the funds in the S corporation. Because it was an ESOP, there'd be no tax paid, and then they could invest those funds inside the S corporation, and voila, they would be able to, you know, by using that, be able to effectively have their income grow tax-free. And it was an amazing deal, except for a couple of problems. Let's first go to their claim of factoring. Now, the problem the court had with the factoring was that they didn't believe any factoring really was taking place. They said, look, the point of factoring is this. When you factor receivables, the idea is that we are going to take our accounts receivable and we need liquidity. So what we do is we sell that to an entity that basically sends us over cash. Couple of problems. When they established this partnership that was going to provide the factoring, the partnership, they really put very, very, very little funds in it. So it had to operate for a number of months as the management company in order to get enough cash to begin to try to factor. Secondly, even then, quite often when they went to factor receivables, they weren't able to actually pay for them right away. They paid for them over time, which when you think about it, kind of defeats the whole purpose of factoring. I don't go to a factor to just get a new receivable, which is what they were getting. So we factored over time. Then third, the big issue was that essentially, they ended up charging a fee. That fee was never taken. They never took a look where that fee they were getting was reasonable. You know, was that a reasonable factoring charge? In fact, as the IRS expert testified, the court accepted, at best, their factoring fee was on the extreme high end of the range for what they could have gotten in the market. The court determined that in reality, this was not providing liquidity. In fact, all it would do is it would buy receivables whenever it had the cash to do so to earn the fees. Oh, and even better, the factoring partnership didn't actually collect the receivables because it didn't have anybody there to collect them. So all the collection work remained inside the main corporations who were supposed to be paid for this work. But interestingly enough, they never were, because of course, if we pay them, that's going to give them income, which is going to kind of make the situations worse, which we don't want to have happen. So basically what we end up with here is a bit of a mess. The court decided after that, they said, look, okay, we're going to say that of all this money coming through to the partnership and then to the individuals, the court allowed reasonable compensation. They said, really, this is all effectively payments to the officers. And in what was kind of a nice approach in this structure, because the court could have been a lot nastier, they did say the amount that was paid that represented reasonable compensation was value given. Nothing else was. The court then found that basically the other payments that were made were constructive dividends. And that meant, of course, the double tax took place. They were taxed once to the individual. They're taxed once to say the corporate level tax the second time when they came out, quote, to the individual, who then, under this rule, was deemed to pay them over to the S corporation, which, of course, you know, then holds them inside of itself. Now, we don't even get to the point as where the ESOPs now manage to have anything worthwhile. But we have these big capital contributions to the S corporations being made by the individuals. By the way, the IRS probably can just leave that alone, because that's getting lots of, that's basically having capital contributed by a non-shareholder. Yeah, that's getting, you know, that's beginning to look like awfully close to something that'd be a prohibited transaction or overfunding in the plans. We don't know how they handled the plans here, but it's not going to be nice. The result here is not going to be a good one. So bottom line, this just didn't quite work. In essence, the deal was too good to be true. And unfortunately, that's exactly what the court ended up holding. Next, the big note of the week. We finally got the proposed regulations for the state and local tax workarounds. This is Regulation 112176-18. This was issued on August the 23rd. As you may recall, under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, if you have state and local taxes in excess of $10,000 on Schedule A, you're capped at $10,000 for your deduction. Obviously, in a number of states, especially states that have higher either income tax rates or property tax rates, that $10,000 ends up being a limitation that a lot of taxpayers are going to hit. So those states have been screaming about that, and they started coming up with an idea. They borrowed from states that had been using a program to a large degree, at least 20 of the states used it for private tuition organizations, but then it got used for a bunch of other things. So 30 states had programs something like this. Those states would say, you make a donation to this favored charity, and let's say you give $1,000 to the favored charity, the state would give you $1,000 off your state taxes for the year. And the position they were taking was, and it was based eventually on a 2010 chief counsel advice that said you ignored the state tax benefits, that these people were able to get $1,000 off their state taxes. So they were essentially, you know, basically their contribution was paid for by the state because they got out of a liability they otherwise would have faced. But on top of that, they still got to take the $1,000 charitable contribution. So by paying out $1,000, let's say you're in the 39.6% bracket, in the past, you could pay out $1,000, you'd get your $1,000 back from the state, and because you took it as a federal deduction, you essentially also get $396 from the feds. Well, this is great, right? We make money that way. Well, you know, now especially the states of New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Oregon did something that's a little bit different. So the Oregon program, which by the way is in its bid mode this week, which we'll note is going to be an interesting problem. But those states, they came up and said, well, if you can do that for that, governments are charitable organizations under the charitable deductions. You can make a charitable contribution to, you know, I could decide to make a charitable contribution to the city of Phoenix and I can take a deduction, make a charitable contribution. So why don't we have the state set up a charitable fund? People can make a donation for that. And then just like these private school tuition organizations, we're going to let our people take dollar for dollar off the state taxes. Well, in fact, in the past programs, it was a bit less than that. They said, hey, we're not going to go that far. We're going to give them like an 85% credit. So if you make a $10,000 contribution to this fund, we're going to give you $8,500 as a reduction of your state taxes. As I say, the private school tuition organization credits and most of the other credits here in Arizona are dollar for dollar. You make a $1,000 contribution, you get a $1,000 credit. So they're saying, look, we're not even being that greedy. We're going to be less greedy. So we're going to do that. Now, Treasury came out with a notice a number of months back that said, hey, wait a minute. You know, we see you guys trying to work around this $10,000 limit. And you guys, we know that's what you're trying to do. So we're going to put regulations out that are going to put a stop to this at this point. And they said, we're going to use substance over form principles. They suggested those principles be what would be used. Well, those regulations were finally issued this week. And interestingly enough, substance over form is never mentioned in these regulations. Rather, the IRS decided to go the quid pro quo contribution rule regulations under 1.170 cap A-1H3. They're saying if you give $1,000 to the state, and then the state reduces your taxes by $1,000, that's a quid pro quo contribution. And that means you have to reduce what you gave by the amount that you knew you were going to get back if you made that gift. The catch with going quid pro quo, though, was that the quid pro quo, how you like that, say that quickly a number of times. The quid pro quo rules meant that it applied to all of the state tax credit programs, including those in existence before the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. As I know, those of you here in Arizona with me know, we had a bunch of them. You could get credits for everything. In fact, somebody was adding them up while we're talking about this week and ended up deciding there was a way to get over $7,000 of credits, you know, pay these amounts to the charities, and you reduced your state taxes by $7,000 dollar for dollar if you maximized all the Arizona options. In fact, that wasn't even true. If you really maximize them all, we could take down much bigger numbers if you happened to own an S corporation. You know, if you had an S corporation we could use and you could win the bid, you know, it wasn't even a bid. You basically got lucky and won the lottery, or at least got your stuff in time. We could wipe out a ton, technically up to $83 million if you happen to win your bid on that. Well, all of those credits are also now subject to the quid pro quo rules. Now, the IRS justified this by saying that we understand that 2010 chief counsel advice. And guys, chief counsel advices aren't binding. So, hey, you know, I know we said it, but, you know, we don't have to follow that. But number two, they said, the passage of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act has radically changed how things work. They said prior to TCJA, now there was a big caveat here, if you weren't subject to AMT, well, a lot of people during this were, but let's ignore that problem. If you weren't subject to AMT, did it matter if it got a $1,000 contribution for giving money to an Arizona private school tuition organization, or if it got a $1,000 deduction for paying Arizona state income taxes of $1,000? In reality, if I wasn't subject to AMT, there was no difference in those two. But this year, if I have more than $10,000 of state and local taxes, so I'm paying the state of Arizona, you know, income taxes of $8,000, I have property taxes on my properties here in Arizona of $4,000. Okay, I'm paying $12,000 now. I'm only going to get 10 of that. Now it does matter whether that $1,000 is a tax credit, or is that $1,000 a contribution, which would be fully deductible. There is no limit on that. Or is it Arizona state income taxes, which, wait, I'm already over the tax cap. So they're saying now, any time you get a donation, if that donation is more than 15% of what you gave, you have to reduce the deduction by the credit. They also said, you know, they said, generally, we're not going to worry about the fact you get a state tax deduction for, like, you know, if I make a $1,000 contribution to the Red Cross, I am going to get an Arizona income tax deduction, and I'm going to reduce my Arizona taxes, but only by the standard rate. They're saying, we're not worried about that. However, they did figure out that the states have come up with a workaround for that by saying, hey, give to this, like I said, school tuition organization, and instead of getting a deduction for $1,000, we're going to multiply that by 20, which would get you pretty close to the Arizona tax rate at the top. And so you get a $20,000 deduction for doing this. They're saying, yeah, you know what? If there's a multiplier, if you're getting any more of a deduction than the fair value of what you gave or the dollars that you gave, we're going to force you to do a reduction there. They're going to publish how we're going to do that later. They want to work on that. But they did think about that because that'd been an obvious workaround, not going to work. One surprising item of the proposed regs, though, is when the effective date is. Now, remember, all these programs were set up to be effective for 18. The theory was that, you know, they're going to put these out. Substance over form would have gone back to the beginning. The IRS has apparently decided that this is now a change in their position. So they're going to say it applies to donations made after August 27th of 18. What now? Notice August 27th of 18 is 4 days after they published the reg, or they basically let us know about the reg. August the 27th is most likely the date the reg will be published in the Federal Register. But the catch is there is a small window here. If you are making donations to a tax credit organization, to be able to do it, if you're listening to this before midnight on the evening of Monday, you know, so Monday evening, midnight, you know, the clock strikes midnight and voila, these things now will have to be reduced if you make your contribution after that. So any contribution paid prior to 827 is going to be considered to be under the, well, they don't say it's they don't say you get it deducted. They merely say after 827, you have to reduce it. They didn't say before that there wasn't a problem, so be careful how you do this. Now, this is also interesting because, like, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut hadn't really revved up their charities yet that were going to receive this. New York has scrambled, and actually they did set up a fund that you could use, but New Jersey and Connecticut, they were each going to have localities set up these funds and go with it. They hadn't put out the rules on that yet. So New York is saying that, well, rush right now. You can send this. Here's the address to send it to Albany and get it in. But you have to get it in, of course, you know, paid by Monday. So they're saying, well, postmark should count. Okay. And also, we don't know for sure the contribution counts, but nevertheless, that's what we've got. We know a lot of places in red states, you know, when I'm here in Arizona, and we are actually talking about it here, there's no question people here are scrambling to get things in before Monday at midnight for all those credits they have. So, interesting issue, but yeah, the salt workarounds. Now, will the state still challenge it? Probably. Will they be successful? I think with the regs written like this, it's going to be a lot tougher for the states to be successful. The quid pro quo rules have been around for a long time. I find it very difficult to figure out why they don't apply. In fact, to be totally honest, I and other people I know found it very difficult to figure out why they didn't apply back in 2010. Why in 2010 they didn't just say that's a payment of state income taxes. But they didn't. So I have a feeling that, you know, if you litigate in court, you're going to go and try to use the 2010 chief counsel advice as logic. And quite frankly, I don't really like its logic. I don't think it's correct, but I wasn't against it at the time. I mean, if the IRS wants to go that route, I was all for it. But I think the challenges will be difficult now. We have a couple of other things happening. IRS issued Revenue Procedure 2018-44. This was on August the 22nd, the day before we got these neat things with the state tax workarounds. It's pretty straightforward. It modifies Revenue Procedure 2018-31, Section 15013. That's the rules for automatic method changes from cash to accrual. Why do we need to modify that? Well, you remember there's a provision in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that says if you convert from S corporation to C corporation within the 2-year period after, you know, on and after the date that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was signed into law, if you do that, then we're going to say if you have a method change, you're forced to change an accounting method because of the change from S to C, then instead of a 4-year spread, we're going to give you a 6-year spread. Realistically, the one thing we probably have to do, the one thing that would require us to change from one method to another would be if we were an S corporation, we were using the cash basis of accounting because we weren't forced to use it for being over 10 million or now over, you know, 25 million. We're not forced to change. But we're now changing as we come over. So we're going from cash to accrual because as a C corp, now we're over the $25 million limit and we're going to have to be a cash base. We're going to be an accrual basis entity. So it provides, if you are forced to change, you get a 6-year spread. If you're not forced to change, but you do so voluntarily, because let's say, okay, your average is 24.9 million and you're growing. You're just below the limit. You know that in a year, you're going to clear the $25 million limit, but you're not clearing it right now, but you need to elect, you know, within the 2-year period. So you're electing now. If you make a conversion that is not required, if you go from cash to accrual at the same time you go from S to C and your cash to accrual was not required, you can still elect the 6-year period or continue to use the old 4-year period. Now, if you're mandatory, you have to use the 6 if you're forced to do it. The revenue procedure also notes this does not affect any other method changes you may make when you go from S to C. So this rule change doesn't affect that, won't be involved. I don't know how many people are going to go from S to C who have revenue of over 25 million, but any of those who are and who currently are cash basis, this is the final little piece you needed to figure out how that's going to work for you this year if you decide to terminate the S election and move forward. Finally, those of you who work with not-for-profits, the IRS issued Notice 2018-67. This is one of those notices I've been issuing this year that says, okay, we know we're going to need to issue regulations on this. And to me, this is kind of and we probably won't have time to do it this year, telling us how they're going to handle the separate business, unrelated business income tax rules. Those of you who may remember that, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act removed the ability to net separate trades or businesses in computing unrelated business income for a not-for-profit. Prior to TCJA, if I had 5 trades or businesses, unrelated trades or businesses, I was running in the same not-for-profit, and 4 of them were profitable and 1 of them had a loss, I just added up the profitables and then I reduced my UBIT by the loss. I reduced my UBI, I should say, by the loss. And I paid tax on the net. Beginning this year, you cannot do that. If you have a loss trade or business, that is unrelated business income, loss trade or business, then you have to treat that as a separate, in essence, treat that as an NOL going forward to the following year, which will offset income from that business in the following year. But you cannot net it against your positive ones for this year. Okay. So this tells us some issues. This notice, if you deal with not-for-profits and not-for-profits that you think may have multiple trades or businesses, because that's one of the key issues, what's a trade or business? This notice tells you about how they're going to handle under the regulations, some of the ways they're thinking of dividing up how many trades or businesses you have, because that's obviously a crucial point. So you'll get guidance in there about some of the ways, some of the guidances. They're thinking using NAICS six-digit code classifications. So if you have different ones of those, each one of those is a separate trader business. There, in fact, that's probably where they're going. They also have a discussion about what if the not-for-profit invests in a partnership, okay? So if you invest in a partnership, they give you certain special rules for partnerships. If you meet them, you know, you don't have control of the enterprise or it's de minimis. There are ways that you can treat a partnership that might have, let's say your investment is you went out and you invested in a hedge fund that is passing on information from, you know, 12 different trades or businesses that it's involved in because it's involved in all these other partnerships. Well, you know, you're going to have this little tiny bit of income or loss from 12 different entities. They're saying, we're going to let you treat that all as one if you meet certain requirements. Basically, you have no control of the partnership or your investment is really small. If either one of those are true, then you can do it. They're going to look at small by looking at your percentage of capital and profits interest. Interestingly enough, they're going to take that right off the K-1. They understand that you probably aren't going to be able to get detailed information from a large hedge fund about exactly how they computed your interest in the partnership. Rather, they're going to say, you can just go ahead and use that from the K-1. So we have that issue. Also, in case you are worried about this, if you have a not-for-profit that's getting GILTI income, right? Remember that global, basically the income tax on the global intangibles, low tax income tax, GILTI. If GILTI income is flowing through, if you've got a GILTI issue, they tell us they're going to treat that much like they do subpart F income for a not-for-profit. So if you're worried about that, hey, that's at the very end of it, giving you that. Now, again, these rules take effect this year. One other thing they did tell us, if you do have like an NOL coming from 17, that NOL from 17 is not subject to these rules. It can offset the income. Because you may not at this point, depending on how you've developed the NOL and how many years it's gone, it might be really difficult to go back and figure out exactly what trade or business that NOL should be allocated to. And because of that, they said, okay, NOLs from 17 can offset all unrelated business income. We're going to treat that as being able to be used against all the income. So that is going to go into your net unrelated business income tax calculation this year, rather than having to figure out, did it go against a positive income trader business this year? So that's actually a piece of good news. Okay. Well, we're going to have a few things happening this week. I'm going to remind you, by the way, had a great time this week, had about 115 people sitting in with us in Arizona to talk about the 199 CAPA regulations. I will be doing that one more time on this Thursday, August 30th for the Idaho Society of CPAs. It'll go at 9 a.m. Mountain Daylight Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time, and it'll run to either 12:45 Mountain Daylight Time or 11:45 Pacific Daylight Time. It is a webcast only, so you know it's not going to be, we don't have a live session. Do not go to the society offices in Boise. I will not be there. I'm going to be broadcasting from down here, here in Phoenix. You can register for this at the Idaho Society of CPAs website if you haven't already done so. So you can get on there and do it. I'll also, Tuesday and Wednesday of this week, I'll be in South Dakota talking on Tuesday. I'll be doing 2 4-hour sessions, one on retirement plans and, you know, advising your clients on retirement plans for planning purposes. And then also, you know, what we're kind of calling, you know, estate planning for the 99.999%, those who are not filing a 706. We'll talk about how that world's changed. So I'll be doing 2 4-hours on that. Then on Wednesday, I'm going to be doing an advanced partnership course. That is, and both those will be in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. So if you're in the Sioux Falls area or you can get there reasonably, you can put that on. That is, as I recall, a joint presentation of the South Dakota Society and the Iowa Society of CPAs. So if you're in that area, you know, come on by. As always, this is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and by Kaplan. Be sure to check your State Society courses. Again, there's lots of things happening. There's still a few courses, I think, out there, like the one we're doing in Idaho this week. You know, some 199 CAPA stuff is still being discussed. Don't know if it's, to me, it seems really tough to figure out how to get an hour out of the SALT workaround regs, but maybe somebody can figure out how to do an hour webinar on that, not sure. But anyway, check your State Society courses. There's all kinds of options coming up. And by the way, there's going to be a ton of stuff this year on the update courses. So if you haven't signed up for an annual update course, I'd get one in play for this year because there's certainly going to be a lot to talk about. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for this week. Our regular updates go online at the currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com website, so you can check there as I post articles on what's been happening. If you have any questions or comments, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com is a place to send them. If you want to follow me on Twitter, @edzollers, I will post there whenever I post them to the website. I will also, you know, make some other comments there from time to time, so you can post there. Generally, it's going to be tax-related. I don't really want to post there what I've been eating for lunch, or talk about the state of modern politics or any other things. So that's not the nature of my feed. So it's going to be basically tax stuff. I also do tax discussions. I go to the group on Reddit. Yeah, the Elmer Fudd pronunciation. Reddit.com. Reddit.com/r/taxpros. If you want to go there, we have, you know, you can get some discussions there from pros. I also pay attention to the Tax Talk discussion group on Yahoo Groups, which is run by the California Society of CPAs. And I look into the Connect groups on both the Arizona Society and New Jersey Society. So if you have access to any of those, and by the way, the Tax Talk one is open to a CPA license in any state. So you just have to go, you know, search for Yahoo Groups for Tax Talk, ask for permission to come in, and tell Jim Counts that essentially you are a CPA licensed in the state of fill in the blank, and you can get in there, get into the discussions there. Because there's a lot of stuff to bounce around today about all of these things that are happening. We're going to get more developments in the future, so we're going to have lots to talk about here on the program every week and lots to talk about in those groups. So we look forward, though, to seeing you next week on Current Federal Tax Development.